This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Red Sister, First Book of the Ancestor, by Mark Lawrence. Narrated by Heather O'Neill. Prologue. It is important when killing a nun to ensure that you bring an army of sufficient size. For Sister Thorne of the Sweet Mercy Convent, Lanotaxis brought 200 men. From the front of the convent you can see both the northern ice and the southern, but the finer view is out across the plateau and over the narrow lands. On a clear day the coast may be glimpsed, the Sea of Marne a suggestion in blue. At some point in an achingly long history, a people, now lost to knowledge, had built 1,024 pillars out on the plateau. Corinthian giants thicker than a thousand-year oak, taller than a long pine. A forest of stone without order or pattern, covering the level ground from flank to flank so that no spot upon it lay more than 20 yards from a pillar. Sister Thorne waited amid this forest, alone and seeking her center. Lano's men began to spread out between the columns. Thorne could neither see nor hear her foe approach, but she knew their disposition. She had watched earlier as they snaked up the west trail from Styx Valley, 3 and 4 abreast. Pilarthi mercenaries from the ice margins, furs of the white bear and the snow wolf over their leathers, some with scraps of chainmail about them, ancient and dark or bright as new, depending on their luck. Many carried spears, some swords. One man in 5 carried a short bow of recurved horn. Tall men, in the main, fair-haired, their beards short or plaited. The women with lines of blue paint across their cheeks and foreheads, like the rays of a cold sun. Here's a moment. All the world and more has rushed eternity's length to reach this beat of your heart, screaming down the years. And if you let it, the universe, without drawing breath, will press itself through this fractured second and race to the next, on into a new eternity. Everything that is, the echoes of everything that ever was, the roots of all that will ever be, must pass through this moment that you own. Your only task is to give it pause, to make it notice. Thorne stood without motion, for only when you are truly still can you be the center. She stood without sound, for only silent can you listen. She stood without fear, for only the fearless can understand their peril. Hers the stillness of the forest, rooted restlessness, oak slow, pine quick, a seething patience. Hers the stillness of ice walls that face the sea, clear and deep, blue secrets held cold against the truth of the world, a patience of eons stacked against a sudden fall. Hers the stillness of a sorrow-born babe unmoving in its crib, and of the mother, frozen in her discovery, fleeting and forever. Thorne held a silence that had grown old before first she saw the world's light, a quietude passed down generations, the peace that bids us watch the dawn, an unspoken alliance with wave and flame that lets both take all speech from tongues and sets us standing before the waters surge and swell, or waiting to bear witness to fire's consuming dance of joy. Hers the silence of rejection, of a child's hurt, mute, unknowing, a scar upon the years to come. Hers the unvoiced everything of first love, tongue-tied, ineloquent, the refusal to sully so sharp and golden a feeling with anything as blunt as words. Thorne waited. Fearless as flowers, bright, fragile, open to the sky. Brave as only those who've already lost can be. Voices reached her, the Pilarthi calling out to each other as they lost sight of their numbers in the broken spaces of the plateau. Cries rang across the level ground, echoing from the pillars, flashes of torchlight, a multitude of footfalls growing closer. Thorne rolled her shoulders beneath black skin armor. She tightened the fingers of each hand around the sharp weight of a throwing star, her breathing calm, heart racing. In this place, the dead watch me. She breathed. A shout broke out close at hand. Figures glimpsed between two pillars, flitting across the gap. Many figures. I am a weapon in service to the Ark. Those who come against me will know despair. Her voice rose along with the tension that always presaged a fight. A buzzing tingle across her cheekbones. A tightness in her throat. A sense of being both deep within her own body and above and around it at the same time. The first of the Polarthi jogged into view and, seeing her, stumbled to a halt. A young man, beardless, though hard-eyed beneath the iron of his helm. More crowded in behind him, spilling out into the killing ground. The Red Sister tilted her head to acknowledge them. Then it began. Chapter 1. No child truly believes they will be hanged, even on the gallows platform with the ropes scratching at their wrists and the shadow of the noose upon their face. They know that someone will step forward, a mother, a father returned from some long absence, a king dispensing justice. Someone. Few children have lived long enough to understand the world into which they were born. Perhaps few adults have either, but they at least have learned some bitter lessons. Saida climbed the scaffold steps as she had climbed the wooden rungs to the Kaltas attic so many times. They all slept there together, the youngest workers, bedding down among the sacks and dust and spiders. They would all climb those rungs tonight and whisper about her in the darkness. Tomorrow night the whispers would be spent, and a new boy or girl would fill the empty space she left beneath the eaves.
"I didn't do anything,"
Saida said it without hope, her tears dry now. The wind sliced cold from the west, a corridor wind, and the sun burned red, filling half the sky yet offering little heat. Her last day. The guard prodded her on, indifferent rather than unkind. She looked back at him, tall, old, flesh tight as if the wind had worn it down to the bone. Another step, the noose dangling dark against the sun. The prison yard lay near deserted, a handful watching from the black shadows where the outer wall offered shelter. Old women, grey hair trailing. Saida wondered what drew them. Perhaps being so old they worried about dying and wanted to see how it was done.
"I didn't do it. It was Nona. She even said so."
She had spoken the words so many times that meaning had leached away, leaving them just pale noise. But it was true. All of it. Even Nona said so. The hangman offered Saida the thinnest of smiles and bent to check the rope confining her wrists. It itched, and it was too tight. Her arm hurt where Ramel had cracked it. But Saida said nothing. Only scanned the yard, the doors to the cell blocks, the outer buildings, even the great gates to the world outside. Someone would come. A door clanged open from the pivot, a squat tower where the warden was said to live in luxury to rival any lords. A guardsman emerged, squinting against the sun. Just a guardsman. The hope that had leapt so easily inside his breast crashed once more. Stepping from behind the guardsman, a smaller, wider figure. Saida looked again, hoping again. A woman in the long habit of a nun came walking into the yard. Only the staff in her hand, its end curled and golden, marked her office. The hangman glanced across, his narrow smile replaced by a broad frown.
"The abbess? I ain't seen her down here before."
The old guardsman tightened his fingers on Saida's shoulder. Saida opened her mouth but found it too dry for her thoughts. The abbess had come for her. Come to take her to the ancestors' convent. Come to give her a new name and a new place. Saida wasn't even surprised. She had never truly thought she would be hanged. Chapter 2. Chapter 2 The stench of a prison is an honest one. The guards' euphemisms, the public smile of the chief warden, even the building's facade may lie and lie again. But the stink is the unvarnished truth, sewage and rot, infection and despair. Even so, Harriton prison smelled sweeter than many. A hanging prison like Harriton doesn't give its inmates the chance to rot. A brief stay, a long drop on a short rope, and they could feed the worms at their leisure in a convict ditch grave up at the pauper's cemetery in Winscombe. The smell bothered Argus when he first joined the guard. They say that after a while your mind steps around any smell without noticing. It's true, but it's also true of pretty much every other bad thing in life. After 10 years, Argus's mind stepped around the business of stretching people's necks just as easily as it had acclimatized to Harriton's stink.
When you leaving?
Dava's obsession with everyone else's schedule used to annoy Argus, but now he just answered without thought or memory.
Seventh bell.
Seventh?
The little woman rattled out her usual outrage at the inequities of the work rota. They ambled towards the main holding block, the private scaffold at their back. Behind them, Jamie Lender dangled out of sight beneath the trap door, still twitching. Jamie was the graveman's problem now. Old man Herber would be along soon enough with his cart and donkey for the day's take. The short distance to Winscombe Hill might prove a long trip for old Herber, his 5 passengers, and the donkey, near as geriatric as its master. The fact that Jamie had no meat on him to speak of would lighten the load. That, and the fact 2 of the other 4 were small girls. Herber would wind his way through the cutter streets and up to the academy first, selling off whatever body parts might have a value today. What he added to the grave ditch up on the hill would likely be much diminished, a collection of wet ruins if the day's business had been good.
6th bell yesterday, 5th the day before.
Dava paused the rant that had sustained her for years, an enduring sense of injustice that gave her the backbone to handle condemned men 2x her size.
Who's that?
A tall figure was knocking at the door to the new arrival's block with a heavy cane.
Fellow from the Cultus, you know.
Dava snapped her fingers before her face as if trying to surprise the answer out.
Rams fighters.
Partners Reeve?
Argus called the name as he remembered it, and the big man turned.
Been a while.
Partners visited the day jail often enough to get his fighters out of trouble. You don't run a stable of angry and violent men without them breaking a few faces off the payroll from time to time. But generally they didn't end up at Harriton. Professional fighters usually keep a calm enough head to stop short of killing during their bar fights. It's the amateurs who lose their minds and keep stamping on a fallen opponent until there's nothing left but mush.
My friend.
Partners turned with arms wide, a broad smile and no attempt at Argus's name.
I'm here for my girl. Your girl?
Argus frowned.
Didn't know you were a family man. Indentured. A worker.
Partners waved the matter aside.
Open the door, will you, good fellow? She's down to drop today, and I'm late enough as it is.
He frowned, as if remembering some sequence of irritating delays. Argus lifted the key from his pocket, a heavy piece of ironwork.
Probably missed her already, partners. Sun's a-setting. Old Herber and his cart will be creaking down the alleys, ready for his take.
Both of them creaking, eh? Herber and his cart?
Dava put in, always quick with a joke, never funny.
I sent a runner, partner said, with instructions that the Cultus girl shouldn't be dropped before. Instructions?
Argus paused, key in the lock.
Suggestions, then. Suggestions wrapped around a silver coin.
Oh.
Argus turned the key and led him inside. He took his visitor by the quickest route, Through the guard station, along the short corridor where the day's arrivals watched from the narrow windows in their cell doors, and out into the courtyard where the public scaffolds sat below the warden's window. The main gates had already opened, ready to admit the graveman's cart. A small figure waited close to the scaffold steps, a single guardsman beside her, John Fallon, by the look of it.
"Just in time,"
Argus said.
"Good."
Partner started forward, then faltered.
"Isn't that..."
He trailed off, lips curling into a snarl of frustration. Following the tall man's gaze, Argus spotted the source of his distress. The Abbess of Sweet Mercy came striding through the small crowd of onlookers before the warden's steps. At this distance she could be anyone's mother, a shortish, plumpish figure swathed in black cloth, but her crozier announced her.
"Dear heavens, that awful old witch has come to steal from me yet again."
Partners both lengthened and quickened his stride, forcing Argus into an undignified jog to keep pace. Dava, on the man's other side, had to run. Despite Partners's haste, he beat the abbess to the girl by only a fraction.
"Where's the other one?"
He looked around as if the guardsman might be hiding another prisoner behind him.
"Other what?"
John Fallon's gaze flickered past Partners to the advancing nun, her habit swirling as she marched.
"Girl, there were two. I gave orders to. I sent a request that they be held back. Over with the dropped."
Fallon tilted his head towards a mound beside the main gates, several feet high. Stones pinned a stained grey sheet across the heap. The graveman's cart came into view as they watched.
"Damnation!"
The word burst from Partners loud enough to turn heads all across the yard. He raised both hands, fingers spread, then trembling with effort, lowered them to his sides.
"I wanted them both."
"Have to argue with the graveman over the big one," Fallon observed.
"Listen."
He reached for the girl at his side.
"You'll have to argue with me over. Then those two."
He nodded at Dava and Argus.
"Then the warden." "There'll be no arguing."
The abbess stepped between Fallon and Partners, dwarfed by both, her crozier reaching up to break their eye contact.
"I shall be taking the child."
"No, you won't."
Partners looked down at her, brow furrowed.
"All due respect to the ancestor and all that, but she's mine, bought and paid for."
He glanced back at the gates where Herber had now halted his cart beside the covered mound.
"Besides, how do you know she's the one you want?"
The abbess snorted and favoured Partners with a motherly smile.
"Of course she is. You can tell by looking at her, Partners Reeve. This child has the fire in her eyes."
She frowned.
"I saw the other. Scared. Lost. She should never have been here."
"Side is back in the cells,"
the girl said.
"They told me I would go first."
Argus peered at the child, a small thing, in shapeless linen, not street rags, covered in rusty stains, but a serf's wear nonetheless. She might be 9. Argus had lost the knack for telling. His older two were long grown, and little Sally would always be 5. This girl was a fierce creature, a scowl on her thin, dirty face, eyes black, below a short shock of ebony hair.
"Might have been the other,"
Partners said.
"She was the big one."
He lacked conviction. A fight master knows the fire when he sees it.
"Where's Sida?"
the girl asked. The abbess's eyes widened a fraction. It almost looked like hurt, gone quicker than the shadow of a bird's wing. Argus decided he imagined it. The abbess of Sweet Mercy was called many things, few of them to her face, and soft wasn't one of them.
"Where's my friend?"
the girl repeated.
"Is that why you stayed?"
the abbess asked. She pulled a whore apple from her habit, so dark a red it could almost be black, a bitter and woody thing. A mule might eat one. Few men would.
stayed?
Dava asked, though the question hadn't been pointed her way.
She stayed 'cause this is a bloody prison, and she's tied and under guard.
Did you stay to help your friend? The girl didn't answer, only glared up at the woman as if at any moment she might leap upon her.
Catch!
The abbess tossed the apple towards the girl. Quick as quick, a small hand intercepted it, apple smacking into palm. Behind the girl, a length of rope dropped to the ground.
Catch!
The abbess had another apple in hand and threw it hard. The girl caught it in her other hand.
Catch!
Quite where the abbess had hidden her fruit supply, Argus couldn't tell, but he stopped caring a heartbeat later, staring at the third apple trapped between two hands, each full of the previous two.
Catch!
The abbess tossed yet another whore apple, but the girl dropped her three and let the fourth sail over her shoulder.
Where's Saida?
You come with me, Nona Grey, the abbess said, her expression kindly.
We will discuss Saida at the convent. I'm keeping her.
Partner stepped towards the girl.
A treasured daughter. Besides, she damn near killed Raymel Taxus. The family will never let her go free. But if I can show she has value, they might let me put her into a few fights first.
Raymel's dead. I killed him. I...
Treasured?
I'm surprised you let her go, Mr. Reeve.
The abbess cut across the girl's protests.
I wouldn't have if I'd been there.
Partners clenched his hand as if trying to recapture the opportunity.
I was halfway across the city when I heard. Got back to find the place in chaos. Blood everywhere. Taxus men waiting. If the city guard hadn't hauled her up here, she'd be in Thurin's private dungeon by now. He's not a man to lose a son and sit idle.
Which is why you will give her to me.
The abbess's smile reminded Argus of his mother's. The one she had used when she was right, and they both knew it.
Your pockets aren't deep enough to get young Nona out of here should the Taxus boy die. And if you did obtain her release, neither you nor your establishment are sufficiently robust to withstand Thurin Taxus's demands for retribution.
The girl tried to interrupt.
How do you know my name?
I didn't.
Whereas I have been friends with Warden James longer than you have been alive, Mr. Reeve.
The abbess cut across the girl again.
And no sane man would mount an attack on a convent of the faith. You shouldn't take her for a red sister.
Partners had that sullen tone men get when they know they've lost.
It's not right. She's got no ancestor faith, and she's all but a murderer. Vicious it was. The way they tell it. Faith, I can give her. What she's got already is what the Red Sisters need.
The abbess reached out a plump hand towards the girl.
Come, Nona.
Nona glanced up at John Fallon, at Partners Reeve, at the hangman, and the noose swaying beside him.
Saida is my friend. If you've hurt her, I'll kill you all.
In silence she walked forward, placing her feet so as not to step on the fallen apples, and took the abbess's hand. Argus and the others watched them leave. At the gates they paused, black against the red sun. The child released the abbess's hand, and took three paces towards the covered mound. Old Herber and his mule stood, watching, as bound by the moment as the rest of them. Nona stopped, staring at the mound. She looked towards the men at the gallows, a long, slow look, then returned to the abbess. Seconds later the pair had vanished around the corner.
"Marking us for death, she was,"
Dava said. Still joking. Still not funny. Chapter 3. A juggler once came to Nona's village, a place so small it had neither a name nor a market square. The juggler came dressed in mud and faded motley, a lean look about him. He came alone, a young man, dark eyes, quick hands. In a sackcloth bag he carried balls of coloured leather, batons with white and black ribbons, and crudely made knives.
"Come, watch the great Amondo. We'll delight and amaze."
It sounded like a phrase he didn't own. He introduced himself to the handful of villagers not labouring in field or hut, and yet brave enough to face a corridor wind laced with icy rain. Laying his hat between them, broad-brimmed and yawning for appreciation, he reached for four striped batons and set them dancing in the air. Amondo stayed 3 days, though his audience dried up after the first hour of the first evening. The sad fact is that there's only so much entertainment to be had from one man juggling, however impressive he might be. Nona stayed by him, though, watching every move, each deft tuck and curl and switch. She stayed even after the light failed and the last of the children drifted away. Silent and staring, she watched as the juggler started to pack his props into their bag. "You're a quiet one." Amondo threw her a wizened apple that sat in his hat, along with several better examples. 2 bread rolls, a piece of Kennel's hard goat's cheese, and somewhere amongst them a copper halfpenny clipped back to a quarter. Nona held the apple close to her ear, listening to the sound of her fingers against its wrinkles.
"The children don't like me."
"No?"
"No."
Amondo waited, juggling invisible balls with his hands.
"They say I'm evil."
Amondo dropped an invisible ball. He left the others to fall and raised a brow.
"Mother says they say it because my hair is so black and my skin is so pale. She says I get my skin from her and my hair from my da."
The other children had the tan skin and sandy hair of their parents, but Nona's mother had come from the ice fringes, and her father's clan hunted up on the glaciers, strangers, both of them.
"Mother says they just don't like different."
"Those are ugly ideas for children to have in their heads."
The juggler picked up his bag. Nona stood watching the apple in her hand, but not seeing it. The memory held her. Her mother in the dimness of their hut, noticing the blood on her hands for the first time.
"What's that? Did they hurt you?"
Nona had hung her head and shook it.
"Bill and Smithson tried to hurt me. This was inside him."
"Best get along home to your ma and pa."
Amondo turned slowly, scanning the huts, the trees, the barns.
"My da's dead. The ice took him."
"Well then,"
a smile only half sad,
"I'd best take you home."
He pushed back the length of his hair and offered his hand.
"We're friends, aren't we?"
Nona's mother let Amondo sleep in their barn, though it wasn't really more than a shed for the sheep to hide in when the snows came. She said people would talk, but that she didn't care. Nona didn't understand why anyone would care about talk. It was just noise. On the night Amondo left, Nona went to see him in the barn. He had spread the contents of his bag before him on the dirt floor, where the red light of the moon spilled in through the doorway.
"Show me how to juggle," she said.
He looked up from his knives and grinned, dark hair swept down across his face, dark eyes behind.
"It's difficult. How old are you?"
Nona shrugged.
"Little."
They didn't count years in the village. You were a baby, then little, then big, then old, then dead.
"Little is quite small."
He pursed his lips.
"I've 2 years and 20. I guess I'm supposed to be big."
He smiled, but with more worry in it than joy, as if the world made no more sense and offered no more comfort to bigs than littles.
"Let's have a go."
Amondo picked up 3 of the leather balls. The moonlight made it difficult to see their colours, but with focus approaching, it was bright enough to throw and catch. He yawned and rolled his shoulders. A quick flurry of hands and the three balls were dancing in their interlaced arcs. There, he caught them. You try. Nona took the balls from the juggler's hands. Few of the other children had managed with two. Three balls was a dismissal. Amanda watched her turning them in her hands, understanding their weight and feel. She had studied the juggler since his arrival. Now she visualized the pattern the balls had made in the air, the rhythm of his hands. She tossed the first ball up on the necessary curve and slowed the world around her. Then the second ball lazily departing her hand. A moment later, all three were dancing to her tune.
Impressive!
Amanda got to his feet.
Who taught you?
Nona frowned and almost missed her catch.
You did.
Don't lie to me, girl.
He threw her a fourth ball, brown leather with a blue band. Nona caught it, tossed it, struggled to adjust her pattern, and within a heartbeat, she had all four in motion, arcing above her in long and lazy loops. The anger on Amondo's face took her by surprise. She had thought he would be pleased, that it would make him like her. He had said they were friends, but she had never had a friend, and he said it so lightly. She had thought that sharing this might make him say the words again and seal the matter into the world. Friend. She fumbled a ball to the floor on purpose, then made a clumsy swing at the next.
A circus man taught me.
She lied. The balls rolled away from her into the dark corners where the rats live.
I practice. Every day. With stones. Smooth ones from the stream.
Amanda closed off his anger, putting a brittle smile on his face.
Nobody likes to be made a fool of, Nona. Even fools don't like it.
How many can you juggle?
She asked. Men like to talk about themselves and their achievements. Nona knew that much about men, even if she was little.
Good night, Nona.
And dismissed, Nona had hurried back to the two-room hut she shared with her mother, with the light of the moon's focus blazing all about her, warmer than the noonday sun.
Foster girl!
The abbess jerked Nona's arm, pulling her out of her memories. The whore apples had put Amanda back into her mind. The woman glanced over her shoulder. A moment later, she did it again.
Quickly!
Why?
Nona asked, quickening her pace.
Because Warden James will have his men out after us soon enough. Me, they'll scold. You, they'll hang. So pick those feet up.
You said you'd been friends with the Warden since before Partner Sreeve was a baby.
So you were listening.
The abbess steered them up a narrow alley so steep it required a step or two every few yards, and the roofs of the tall houses stepped one above the next to keep pace. The smell of leather hit Nona, reminding her of the coloured balls Amanda had handed her, as strong a smell as the stink of cows, rich, deep, polished, brown.
You said you and the Warden were friends?
Nona said again.
I've met him a few times, the abbess replied. Nasty little man, bald and squinty, uglier on the inside.
She stepped around the wares of a cobbler, laid out before his steps. Every other house seemed to be a cobbler's shop, with an old man or young woman in the window, hammering away at boot heels or trimming leather.
You lied?
To call something a lie, child, is an unhelpful characterization.
The abbess drew a deep breath, laboring up the slope.
Words are steps along a path. The important thing is to get where you're going. You can play all manner of rules. Step on a crack, break your back. But you'll get there quicker if you pick the most certain route.
But
lies are complex things. Best not to bother thinking in terms of truth or lie. Let necessity be your mother, and invent.
You're not a nun.
Nona wrenched her hand away.
And you let them kill Saida.
If I had saved her, then I would have had to leave you.
Shouts rang out somewhere down the steepness of the alley.
Quickly!
The alley gave onto a broad thoroughfare by a narrow flight of stairs, and the abbess turned onto it, not pausing now to glance back.
They know where we're going.
Nona had done a lot of running and hiding in her short life, and she knew enough to know it didn't matter how fast you went if they knew where to find you.
They know when we get there they can't follow.
People choked the street, but the abbess wove a path through the thickest of the crowd. Nona followed, so close that the tails of the nun's habit flapped about her. Crowds unnerved her. There hadn't been as many people in her village, nor in her whole world, as pressed into this street. And the variety of them, some adults hardly taller than she was, others overtopping even the hulking giants who fought at the Kaltus. Some dark, their skin black as ink, some white blonde and so pale as to show each vein in blue and every shade between. Through the alleys rising to join the street, Nona saw a sea of roofs, tiled in terracotta, stubbled with innumerable chimneys, smoke drifting. She had never imagined a place so big, so many people crammed so tight. Since the night the child-taker had driven Nona and his other purchases into Verity, she had seen almost nothing of the city, just the combat hall, the compound where the fighters lived, and the training yards. The cart ride to Harriton had offered only glimpses as she and Sida sat hugging each other.
Through here!
The abbess set a hand on Nona's shoulder and aimed her at the steps to what looked like a pillared temple, great doors standing open, each studded with 100 circles of bronze. The steps were high enough to put an ache in Nona's legs. At the top, a cavernous hall waited, lit by high windows, every square foot of it packed with stalls and people hunting bargains. The sound of their trading, echoing and multiplied by the marble vaults above, spoke through the entrance with one many-tongued voice. For several minutes it was nothing but noise and colour and pushing. Nona concentrated on filling the void left as the abbess stepped forward before some other body could occupy the space. At last they stumbled into a cool corridor and out into a quieter street behind the market hall.
"Who are you?"
Nona asked. She had followed the woman far enough.
"And?"
Realizing something.
"Where's your stick?"
The abbess turned, one hand knotted in the string of purple beads around her neck.
"My name is Glass. That's Abbess Glass to you. And I gave my crozier to a rather surprised young man shortly after we emerged from Shoe Street. I hope the warden's guards followed it, rather than us."
"Glass isn't a proper name. It's a thing. I've seen some in Partness Reeve's office."
Something hard and near invisible that kept the corridor winds from the fight master's den. Abbess Glass turned away and resumed her marching.
"Each sister takes a new name when she is deemed fit to marry the ancestor. It's always the name of an object or thing, to set us apart from the worldly."
"Oh?"
Most in Nona's village had prayed to the nameless gods of rain and sun, as they did all across the grey, setting corn dollies in the fields to encourage a good harvest. But her mother and a few of the younger women went to the new church over in White Lake, where a fierce young man talked about the God who would save them, the Hope, rushing towards us even now. The roof of the Hope Church stood ever open so they could see the God advancing. To Nona, he looked like all the other stars, only white, where almost every other is red, and brighter too. She had asked if all the other stars were gods as well, but all that earned her was a slap. Preacher Mickle said the star was Hope, and also the one God, and that before the northern ice and the southern ice joined hands, he would come to save the faithful. In the cities, though, they mainly prayed to the ancestor.
"There! See it?"
Nona followed the line of the abbess's finger. On a high plateau, beyond the city wall, the slanting sunlight caught on a domed building, perhaps 5 miles off.
"Yes, that's where we're headed."
And the abbess led away along the street, stepping around a horse pile too fresh for the garden boys to have got to yet.
"You didn't hear about me all the way up there?"
Nona asked. It didn't seem possible. Abbas Glass laughed, a warm and infectious noise.
"Ha! No! I had other business in town. One of the faithful told me your story, and I made a diversion on my way back to the convent."
"Then how did you know my name? My real name? Not the one Partness gave me?"
"Could you have caught the fourth apple?"
The abbess responded with a question.
"How many apples can you catch, old woman?"
"As many as I need to."
Abbess Glass looked back at her.
"Hurry up now."
Nona knew that she didn't know much, but she knew when someone was trying to take her measure, and she didn't like things being taken from her. The abbess would have kept on with her apples until she found Nona's limit, and held that knowledge like a knife in its sheath. Nona hurried up and said nothing. The streets grew emptier as they approached the city wall, and the shadows started to stretch. Alleyways yawned left and right, dark mouths ready to swallow Nona whole. However warm the abbess's laughter, Nona didn't trust her. She had watched Sida die. Running away was still very much an option. Living with a collection of old nuns on a windswept hill outside the city might be better than hanging, but not by much.
"Master Reeve said that Raymel wasn't dead."
"That's not true."
The abbess pulled her coif off in a smooth motion, revealing short grey hair and exposing her neck to the wind. She quickly threw a shawl of sequined wool about her shoulders.
"Where did... you stole that?"
Nona glanced around to see if any of the passers-by would share her outrage, but they were few and far between, heads bowed, bound to their own purposes.
"A thief and a liar!"
"I value my integrity," the abbess smiled. "Which is why it has a price."
"A thief and a liar."
Nona decided that she would run.
"And you, child, appear to be complaining because the man you were to hang for murdering is not, in fact, dead."
Abbess Glass tied the shawl and tugged it into place.
"Perhaps you can explain what happened at the Caltus, and I can explain what Partness Reeve almost certainly meant about Raymel Taxus."
"I killed him."
The abbess wanted a story, but Nona kept her words close. She had come to talking so late her mother had thought her dumb, and even now she preferred to listen.
"How? Why? Paint me a picture."
Abbess Glass made a sharp turn, pulling Nona through a passage so narrow that a few more pounds about her middle would see the nun scraping both sides.
"They brought us to the Caltus in a cage."
Nona remembered the journey. There had been three children on the wagon when Giljon, the child-taker, stopped at her village, and the people gave her over. Grey Stephen had passed her up to him. It seemed that everyone she knew watched as Giljon put her in the wooden cage with the others. The village children, both littles and bigs, looked on mute. The old women muttered. Mary Streams, her mother's friend, had sobbed. Martha Baker had shouted cruel words. When the wagon jolted off along its way, stones and clods of mud had followed.
"I didn't like it."
The wagon had rattled on for days, then weeks. In 2 months they had covered nearly 1,000 miles, most of it on small and winding lanes, back and forth across the same ground. They rattled up and down the corridor, weaving a drunkard's trail north and south, so close to the ice that sometimes Nona could see the walls rising blue above the trees. The wind proved the only constant, crossing the land without friendship, a stranger's fingers trailing the grass, a cold intrusion. Day after day, Giljon steered his wagon from town to town, village to hamlet, to lonely hovel. The children given up were gaunt, some little more than bones and rags, their parents lacking the will or coin to feed them. Giljon delivered 2 meals a day, barley soup with onions in the morning, hot, unsalted, with hard black bread to dip. In the evening, mashed swede with butter. His passengers looked better by the day.
"I've seen more meat on a butcher's apron."
That's what Giljon told Saida's parents when they brought her out of their hut into the rain. The father, a ratty little man, stooped and gone to grey, pinched Saida's arm.
"Big girl for her age. Strong. Got a lick of gerent in her."
The mother, whey-faced, stick-thin, weeping, reached to touch Saida's long hair but let her hand fall away before contact was made.
"Four pennies, and my horse can graze in your field tonight."
Giljon always dickered. He seemed to do it for the love of the game, his purse being the fattest Nona had ever seen, crammed with pennies, crowns, even a gleaming sovereign that brought a new colour into Nona's life. In the village only Grey Stephen ever had coins, and James Baker that time he sold all his bread to a merchant's party that had lost the track to gentry. But none of them had ever had gold, not even silver.
10, and you get on your way before the hour's old,
the father countered. Within the aforementioned hour, Seda had joined them in the cage, her pale hair veiling a downturned face. The cart moved off without delay, heavier one girl and lighter 5 pennies. Nona watched through the bars, the father counting the coins over and again as if they might multiply in his hand, his wife clutching at herself. The mother's wailing followed them as far as the crossroads.
"How old are you?"
Marcus, a solid dark-haired boy who seemed very proud of his 10 years, asked the question. He had asked Nona the same when she joined them. She had said 9 because he seemed to need a number.
8?
Saida sniffed and wiped her nose with a muddy hand.
8? Hope's blood! I thought you were 13!
Marcus seemed in equal measure both pleased to keep his place as oldest and outraged by Saida's size.
"Gerent in her,"
offered Chara, a dark girl with hair so short her scalp shone through. Nona didn't know what gerent was, except that if you had it, you'd be big. Saida shuffled closer to Nona. As a farm girl, she knew not to sit above the wheels if you didn't want your teeth rattled out.
"Don't sit by her,"
Marcus said.
"Cursed, that one is."
"She came with blood on her,"
Chara said. The others nodded. Marcus delivered the final and most damning verdict.
"No charge!"
Nona couldn't argue. Even Hesse with her withered leg had cost Giljon a clipped penny. She shrugged and brought her knees up to her chest. Saida pushed aside her hair, sniffed mightily, and threw a thick arm about Nona, drawing her close. Alarmed, Nona had pushed back, but there was no resisting the bigger girl's strength. They held like that as the wagon jolted beneath them, Saida weeping, and when the girl finally released her, Nona found her own eyes full of tears, though she couldn't say why. Perhaps the piece of her that should know the answer was broken. Nona knew she should say something, but couldn't find the right words. Maybe she'd left them in the village, on her mother's floor. Instead of silence, she chose to say the thing that she had said only once before, the thing that had put her in the cage.
"You're my friend."
The big girl sniffed, wiped her nose again, looked up, and split her dirty face with a white grin. Giljon fed them well and answered questions at least the first time they were asked, which meant, "Are we there yet?" and
"How much further?"
merited no more reply than the clatter of wheels. The cage served 2 purposes, both of which he explained once, turning his grizzled face back to the children to do so, and letting the mule, Forefoot, choose his own direction.
"Children are like cats, only less useful and less furry. The cage keeps you in one place, or I'd be forever rounding you up. Also,"
he raised a finger to the pale line of scar tissue that divided his left eyebrow, eye socket, and cheekbone,
I am a man of short temper and long regret. Irk me and I will lash out with this or this.
He held out first the cane with which he encouraged Forefoot, and then the calloused width of his palm.
I shall then regret both the sins against the ancestor and against my purse.
He grinned, showing yellow teeth and dark gaps.
The cage saves you from my intemperance, at least until you irk me to a level where my ire lasts the trip around to the door.
The cage could hold 12 children, more if they were small. Giljon continued his meander westward along the corridor, whistling in fair weather, hunched and cursing in foul.
I'll stop when my purse is empty, or my wagon's full.
He said it each time a new acquisition joined them, and it set Nona to wishing Giljon would find some golden child whose parents loved her and who would cost him every coin in his possession. Then at last they might get to the city. Sometimes they saw it in the distance, the smoke of Verity. Closer still, and a faint suggestion of towers might resolve from the haze above the city. Once they came so close that Nona saw the sunlight crimson on the battlements of the fortress that the emperors had built around the Ark. Beneath it, the whole sprawling city bound about with thick walls and sheltering from the wind in the lee of a high plateau. But Giljon turned and the city dwindled once more to a distant smudge of smoke. Nona whispered her hope to Sida on a cold day when the sun burned scarlet over half the sky and the wind ran its fingers through the wooden bars, finding strange and hollow notes.
Giljon doesn't want pretty, Sida snorted. He's looking for breeds.
Nona only blinked.
Breeds, you know. Anyone who shows the blood.
She looked down at Nona, still wide-eyed with incomprehension.
The four tribes?
Nona had heard of them, the four tribes of men who came to the world out of darkness and mixed their lines to bear children who might withstand the harshness of the lands they claimed.
Ma took me to the Hope Church. They didn't like talk of the ancestor.
Sida held her hands up.
Well, there were four tribes.
She counted them off on her fingers.
Geraint. If you've too much Geraint blood, you get big like they were.
She patted her broad chest.
Hanska. They're less common.
She touched Nona's hair.
Hanska dark, Hanska fast.
As if reciting a rhyme.
The others are even rarer. Marjul and... Quantle,
Marcus said from the corner. He snorted and puffed up as if he were an elder.
And it's Marjul, not Marjul.
Sida scowled at him, and turning back she lowered her voice to a whisper.
They can do magic.
Nona touched her hair where Sida's hand had rested. The village littles thought black hair made her evil.
Why does Giljon want children like that? To sell?
Sida shrugged.
He knows the signs to look for. If he's right, he can sell us for more than he paid. Ma said I'll find work if I keep getting big. She said in the city they feed you meat and pay you coins.
She sighed.
I still don't want to go.
Giljon took the lanes that led nowhere, the roads so rutted and overgrown that often it needed all the children pushing and Forefoot straining all four legs to make headway. Giljon would let Marcus lead the mule then. Marcus had a way with the beast. The children liked Forefoot. He smelled worse than an old blanket and had a fondness for nipping legs. But he drew them tirelessly, and his only competition for their affection was Giljon. Several of them fought to bring him whore-apples and sweet grass at the day's end. But of all of them, Forefoot only loved Giljon, who whipped him, and Marcus, who rubbed him between the eyes and spoke the right kind of nonsense when doing it. The rains came for days at a time, making life in the cage miserable, though Giljon did throw a hide over the top and windward side. The mud was the worst of it, cold and sour stuff that took hold of the wheels so that they all had to shove. Nona hated the mud. Lacking Sida's height, she often found herself thigh-deep in the cold and sucking mire, having to be rescued by Giljon as the wagon slurped onto firmer ground. Each time he would knot his fist in the back of her hempen smock and heft her out bodily. Nona set to scraping the goo off as soon as he set her down on the tailgate.
"What a bit of mud to a farm girl?"
Giljon wanted to know. Nona only scowled and kept on scraping. She hated being dirty, always had. Her mother said she ate her food like a high-born lady, holding each morsel with precision so as not to smear herself.
"She's not a farm girl,"
Sida spoke up for her.
"Nona's ma wove baskets."
Giljon returned to the driver's seat.
"She's not anything now, and neither are the rest of you until I sell you. Just mouths to feed."
Roads that led nowhere took them to people who had nothing. Giljon never asked to buy a child. He'd pull up alongside any farm that grew more weeds and rocks than crop. Places where calling the harvest failed would be overgenerous, implying that it had made some sort of effort to succeed. In such places the tenant farmer might pause his plough or lay down his scythe to approach the wagon at his boundary wall. A man driving a wagon load of children in a cage doesn't have to state his business. A farmer whose flesh lies sunken around his bones and whose eyes are the colour of hunger doesn't have to explain himself if he walks up to such a man. Hunger lies beneath all of our ugliest transactions. Sometimes a farmer would make that long, slow crossing of his field from right to wrong, and stand, lean in his overalls, chewing on a cornstalk, eyes aglitter in the shadows of his face. On such occasions it wouldn't take more than a few minutes before a string of dirty children were lined up beside him, graduated in height from those narrowing their eyes against the suspicion of what they'd been summoned for, down to those still clutching in one hand the stick they'd been playing with, and in the other, the rags about their middle, their eyes wide and without guile. Giljon picked out any child with possible gerent traits on a swift first pass. When they knew their ages, it was easier. But even without anything more than a rough guess at a child's years, he would find clues to help him. Often he looked at the backs of their necks, or took their wrists and bent them back, just until they winced. Those children he would set aside. On a second pass he would examine the eyes, pulling at the corners and peering at the whites. Nona remembered those hands. She had felt like a pear picked from the market stall, squeezed, sniffed over, replaced. The village had asked nothing for her. Yet still Giljon had carried out his checks. A space in his cage and meals from his pot had to be earned. With the Hunska possibles, the child-taker would rub the youngster's hair between finger and thumb, as if checking for coarseness. If still curious, he would test their swiftness by dropping a stone so that it fell behind a cloth he held out, and make a game of trying to catch it as it came back into view a couple of feet lower. Almost none of the children taken as Hunska were truly fast. Giljon said they'd grow into it, or training would bring their speed into the open. Nona guessed they might make 10 stops before finding someone prepared to swap their sons and daughters for a scattering of copper. She guessed that after walking the lines of children set out for him, Giljon would actually offer coins fewer than 1 time in a dozen, and that when he did, it was generally for an over-large child. And even of these few, hardly any, he said, would grow into full gerent heritage. After Giljon had picked out these and any dark and over-quick children, he would always return to the line for the third and slowest of his inspections. Here, although he watched with the hawk's intensity, Giljon kept his hands to himself. He asked questions instead.
"Did you dream last night?"
he might ask.
"Tell me, What colours do you see in the focus moon?
And when they told him the moon is always red, when they said that you can't